This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, where we're opening up with some music from an individual by the name of Tae Chung. His album is a compilation of Tibetan folk and freedom songs, which we'll hear more of later tonight, perhaps. And we've also got some other Tibetan music, which has been laid on us by our guest. We're extremely honored to be joined by Jacob Blumenfeld. Welcome aboard, Jacob.
Thank you.
Whoops, wrong mic. Say it one more time. There we go.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I think I still have your wrong mic. God damn it. They used to be color-coded. Try one more time. Now I've got them all on.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
There you go. And listeners who pay attention to the news probably saw your picture in the New York Times and other newspapers on August 19th, I believe it was, when you and some fellow activists unfurled a banner reading Free Tibet at the so-called Bird's Nest. It was outside the Bird's Nest, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Beijing, in the midst of the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
A banner which with these LED throw lights. What exactly are those?
They're LED lights. Some people call them throwies when they have magnets attached to them, and you can just throw them at the wall and they'll stick. Ours didn't have magnets, but they were these little lights that anyone can make and anyone can put on a banner anywhere in the city. And what they do is they light up for about a week unless they're separated from their battery.
Uh-huh. So the idea was that you're going to be doing this action at night, and you wanted it to be seen.
Yeah, usually you can't ever do a banner action at night because you can't get a photo of it or no one will see it. So the idea was for the first time to try to do a night action, And it was, we think, the first time that there was such a light banner done for a political cause.
Uh-huh. So, and why at night? Was there some event happening that you wanted to...
It was just to get the scenery of the images of the background at night. And also, supposedly, we thought it could be easier to do at night. That maybe there weren't as many police or security there. And also, the technology of the LED throwies, which is very simple technology anyone can use, was developed by a New Yorker who was also sympathetic to the Tibetan cause.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah, James Powderly, who was himself in Beijing planning to do another action. Unfortunately, he was arrested before he did it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Well, I'm very curious about how people actually managed to get away with these actions in such a tightly controlled environment and what happened to you all. So I'm sort of interested in hearing the blow-by-blow of your story. When did you decide to do this?
So I've known about the Tibetan cause for a while. My grandparents were survivors of the Holocaust, and ever since then I've had a certain attunement to when people are being oppressed for their nationality or religion or ethnicity. So when I heard about the Tibetan cause, just like when I heard about the Palestinian cause, I investigated it, and I made an effort to take a position or to understand it. And I'm not an expert on it, but I did make a judgment, and with the time of the year it was the Olympics and the spotlight was going to be on China, I knew that it was the time to do something that could be amplified and that wouldn't just be thrown away in another dustbin of history, but it could actually make a spark. For the last 7 years, Students for Free Tibet has been organizing towards this summer, ever since China got the Olympic bid in 2001. And since then, they've been doing a series of actions leading up to this moment. And their goal was to take this moment on when China is using the media to show their face to the world, as they say, to not let them get away with what's going on in Tibet with the occupation. So when people think of China Olympics, they also think of Tibet. This organization, Students for Free Tibet, has 700 chapters in the world and 30 countries. And I have friends who've been in it for a while, and I was approached by a friend who knew my sympathies. I haven't done an action for them before, so it was my first time doing it. But I thought about it. I went over the consequences, and I realized that I was willing to take the consequences, which would be jail time in China, and I'm never allowed to go back in again.
All right. Well, the prior did not happen. You didn't actually do jail time, or did you? Let's not jump ahead of ourselves. So, well, for starters, just out of curiosity, what was your activist background up to this point? What else have you
been involved in? I'm from San Diego, California, where I was involved in some independent media organizing around the San Diego Independent Media Center, around the free radio station called Radioactive Radio. Promoting just independent media so that people can have voice their expression without corporate control. Alongside that, I was involved in some direct action organizing around the border, trying to stop the militarization of the border, especially the vigilante militarization by the Minutemen.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So I was out there in 2005 with a couple of groups trying to stop the Minutemen using our own bodies and using sound and using lights and trying to do some kind of just stopping that and trying to get publicity around what they're doing and how it's affecting.
So basically doing counter-protests against their mobilizations at the border.
Doing camps at the border to stop their actions. I was involved in that with a couple years. And it was sometimes we had successes, sometimes we didn't. But I think the San Diego Minutemen chapter has been effectively, closed down for about 2 years.
Oh, yeah?
Even though there's other chapters in the country. I came to New York in 2006, or 2005, one of those years. And here I've been involved in a couple different projects. One of them has been a child care project, where I'm part of a collective called the Regeneración Child Care Collective. And we do child care for radical women's groups and radical groups that have children in them, or that have mothers. So, for instance, we do child care for Families for Freedom, for Sister to Sister, for Mothers on the Move, and different groups like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a solidarity kind of organization. And I've also been, I've helped out with the 123 community space in Brooklyn. among some other side projects.
Hmm. Where is that?
It's in Bed-Stuy, Tompkins and Myrtle.
Right.
And one other main thing is that I was involved in this Jewish organization called Jews Against the Occupation.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
JADO. Yeah, we've had their people on the show.
Oh, you have? Yeah, great. Sure. Yeah. So it's just a collective of Jews who believe that, you know, being Jewish gives you the responsibility to fight for people's liberation, like Palestine. So I've been involved in part in some of all these groups in my own capacity, and it's been really exciting.
Okay, so you took the decision earlier this summer to go to Beijing.
Yeah, so I took the decision once I knew the consequences, and I thought it was justified. It was a right cause, and we went there in August, around the middle of August, August 15th. But just before I get into my story, there were 6 other actions before mine, involving different banners and different technology,
right,
and 35 other people who were also arrested and deported.
All right, so that's the total number is 35.
Before my group. Mm-hmm. In total, in the whole month, there was 45.
45.
45, yeah.
Arrested and deported.
Mm-hmm. And
mostly Americans? Or
No, probably a third American, mm-hmm, but a lot of folks from the UK, from Germany, from Australia, mm-hmm, and some Tibetan Germans, some Tibetan Americans.
Tibetan diaspora folks.
Yeah, so the idea was to have Tibetan folks engage in these actions themselves, but they were denied visas by the Chinese government because they're not allowed to enter and they're highly watched. So folks like me and people of conscience that were sympathetic to the cause went there knowing the consequences to do it, to amplify those voices that couldn't be there in the first place.
All right, so in your group, there were, according to this media report that I've got, Amy Johnson, Sam Corbin, Liza Smith, Lauren Vallee, and yourself.
Yeah, there was 5 of us. Mm-hmm. We got to Beijing. We all had to get our visas separately, and it's a hard process to actually get a visa to China. You have to have a hotel reservation already. You have to have a recommendation from your workplace.
Mm. Oh, really?
You have to have your flight tickets.
All right, so what about me as a freelancer? Could I not go to China?
You shouldn't ever say that you work with the media or you're a student. Those are not occupations looked upon as good occupations.
Hmm.
So you'd have to say something else, just a warning. But anyone can go. You have to buy your tickets ahead of time. There's a lengthy process. And a lot of people were actually mad about this because tons of people couldn't get to China for the Olympics, which they wanted. But people like us did get in, and it is a huge bureaucratic country, so they can't watch everyone. And we went there, and for a week, we acted like tourists. We basically were tourists. It was our first time there for all of us. We saw the country. We wanted to see what it was like to be in Beijing. We wanted to, you know, feel the moment, like they say, and to understand what was going on in this process of change in China, this transition moment that it's going through, and this kind of global opening moment, just like in the 70s when it was open to the West. Now it's kind of opening again in a global setting. And during that whole time of kind of just sightseeing and relaxing, we also were preparing for action. By sightseeing, by talking to other people, by trying to communicate to the outside world. Communication is very controlled there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you read the reports, but a lot of media or a lot of email was monitored. A lot of hotel rooms were all bugged in the main district. Taxi cabs had bugs in them. Video cameras were set up in a lot of public places. So we had to navigate through all of these things just to communicate, basically. We couldn't really ever talk about what we were going to do in public or even in private. It was very, very, very difficult to even talk about what we were going to do. So it made it very frustrating, one of the most frustrating things I've ever been involved in. But, you know, because of the context was hard, very hard. But using a series of codes, we were able to get by.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
yeah.
So you did have reservations beforehand at a hotel and all that.
We did have. We all had separate reservations at hotels. We all ended up staying at another one that someone got, and it ended up being fine. We spent most of the days really just kind of seeing sights, because one thing that happens there is that, you know, Westerners, there's not that many there really. most of the tourists in Beijing were from Greater China, from rural China. Like mm-hmm. when we went to the Forbidden City or the Great Wall, thousands upon thousands of tourists, but mostly all Chinese. Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple Westerners, a couple athletes. Mm-hmm. So whenever Westerners or Westerners were in a public setting, they usually got followed by undercovers. Mm-hmm. There's tons of undercovers there. Hard to really notice how many there are until you do an action. And you realize that half the people there are undercover.
Okay, now how do you realize it? What clues you in if they're undercover?
Well, once you do something, you know, nominally illegal, like holding a banner, mm-hmm. then you notice that a lot of the crowd kind of turns and is actually part of the police because they're the ones arresting you. Mm-hmm. Before that, you never really know. You never really know. But so a lot of people get followed. So we kind of just saw the sites and tried to just understand what was going on in China, try to talk to people. We couldn't ever talk about Tibet or what we were doing there because it's illegal to talk about Tibet in public.
Okay, now it's actually illegal or it's just sort of de facto illegal? I mean, is there an actual law on the books or is it just like something that you know you're going to get in trouble if you do it?
The policemen that talked to us, they said it's illegal to say that Tibet should be free in public.
Right.
It is illegal. Like, they said you could do it in private. Mm-hmm. But in public, they say, quote, it disturbs the social order.
Yes, right.
And the social order is what should be preserved, yes. Of course.
Okay, now, you were told this at what point?
After we did the action. So, you know, after all the planning and the things, we finally did our action at midnight on Tuesday the 19th. Beijing time.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't sure it was going to work. There was tons of problems. People got arrested. Our friends got arrested before their action happened. Everyone thought they were getting followed. And we did manage to find the spot, the Olympic Stadium, which is in front of the Bird's Nest.
All right, so what's the difference between the Bird's Nest and the Olympic Stadium?
The Olympic Park, I meant to say.
Mm-hmm.
The Bird's Nest is the national stadium, and then there's the Water Cube, which is like the National Aquatic Stadium, which is this super modern architecture. It looks like it's bubbles.
All right. Now, how much of this was newly built for the Olympics?
All of it was newly built for the Olympics.
All right. So the Bird's Nest did not exist a year ago.
No. There was about 30 new buildings built, mm-hmm. with about 8 of them for the Olympics, and then mm-hmm. the rest were just high-rises.
Mm-hmm.
From reports, it was told that $40 billion was spent, $40 U.S. billion were spent on this.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible amount of money, the most ever for an Olympics event before, which I could tell you about what happened to Beijing.
Yeah, well, next, we'll get to that. Yeah. But first, let's continue with your personal saga.
Yeah, so
you unfurl the banner a week ago.
We unfurled this banner with the lights on it, mm-hmm. that said free Tibet in Chinese and English. It was up for about 20 seconds.
Wow, 20 seconds!
Yeah, probably the shortest action I've ever been involved in.
Whoa, but that was long enough, fortunately, for plenty of media to...
Not plenty, for one.
Just one. There was just one photo taken.
There was one person there. I think one or two. I don't really know.
Well, you're lucky somebody got a shot of it to preserve it for posterity.
Yeah, that was, you know, it's all part of the plan.
Oh, okay.
But we didn't, I mean, we didn't know that it worked, basically. We just hoped that they got the photo, and we hoped that it got out. A lot of other reporters were grabbed in other actions, and their memory cards were broken, or their cameras were broken. So we had no idea if they got out.
Okay, now mainstream reporters or alternative type reporters?
Both. Mainstream reporters were usually ruffled up a bit, but they weren't arrested.
Mm.
Independent reporters were arrested. There were some bloggers and indie media people that were arrested for 5 days.
Right.
But even a UK. All right,
that's one thing I was going to ask you, because I saw one report on the Boston Indie Media Center, because one of their people, Brian Conley. All right, now, he was involved in, he was there as a journalist. He was not actually doing an action, right? He was
there covering some of the Free Tibet actions.
Right, as an independent journalist. And according to this report, he was, he received a 10-day sentence, but I guess he didn't serve all of that.
Yeah, him and I think four or five other independent journalists were all rounded up the morning we did our action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So before your action.
Yeah. And
so how did the authorities get onto them?
We don't know.
All right.
I mean,
through surveillance or whatnot.
Through surveillance. Yeah. So there's another story of another group that went to do an action, but they were arrested in their hotel before it happened. So he was there, and they gave him a 10-day sentence. But I think through the international pressure, through the media pressure, they were released after 5 days. Released after 5 days, yeah.
Okay, so what happens to you and your four...
my comrades.
Comrades. You unfurl the banner. It's up for a roll of 20 seconds.
We get the photo, and then immediately there's already three undercovers in the park. This is midnight, by the way. And they immediately pull it down from us and surround us and just hold us there for about 30 minutes while they call their supervisors and their supervisors. And it goes up the bureaucratic chain for about 30 minutes before.
All right, so these guys who held you were plainclothes.
They're plainclothes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was maybe two in clothes, in police. Mm-hmm. But usually it was like 80%. Were plainclothes almost all the time.
All right, and how did they hold you? Did they handcuff you, or
we were never handcuffed? They were just surrounded, mm-hmm. just surrounded. And
were they armed?
I never saw arms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never saw arms. One thing they do is they film you like crazy. Mm-hmm. They had like maybe 20 to 30 people filming you. Mm-hmm. They were all police. They weren't media. Mm-hmm. Police, videographers and photographers, and they filmed us. I don't know, the whole time. Mm-hmm. They film us. They take us. They put us in the car, and. They take us to a university building. We never really found out what it was. There's some gate. They open a gate, and they just drive us into this kind of parking lot of this building. And there's 30 more people that have cameras waiting for us. And in this building, which, you know, has kind of auditoriums and classrooms, that's where they hold us for the remainder of the 12 hours. And that's where they interrogate us, and that's where they keep us until they send us back to the airport.
Okay, so you were just held for 12 hours.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for 12 hours.
All right, and this was a, what was the nature of this building? It was actually a detention center, or?
No, it was probably a university building mm-hmm. that was just unused at night.
Mm-hmm. So they were just sort of using it as an ad hoc
kind of place. And right. At the time, I had no idea why, but now my own idea is that they didn't want us to see the other American prisoners mm-hmm. in the jail. Mm-hmm. So they kept us apart. That's what I think.
Oh, but they kept the five of you together.
They kept the five of us together, yeah.
And when you say interrogated you, how did they interrogate you?
So that's when we were separated. We were all separated for about an hour, uh-huh. where they just ask us questions. And depending on the person, it was either harsh or light. Mine was pretty light. They asked us, you know, our backgrounds, what we're doing there. They asked us about Tibet, you know. Do you know about Tibet? And he said, you know, yes, we know about Tibet. And they proceeded to try to educate us on
Indeed.
Tibet.
Oh?
Did you know Tibet was a part of China for 2,000 years? Mm-hmm. And, you know, stuff like that. And I didn't really want to engage in a political conversation, so I just said, oh, really? I didn't know that, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. And I had this little red book on me when I was there.
Right. So this is an actual copy of the quotations from Chairman Mao that you picked up as a souvenir in Beijing.
In Tiananmen Square. Yeah.
Right. Bilingual.
Bilingual.
Chinese and English.
So I had this on me. They were really curious about this book. They asked me why I had it. Did I read it? You know, they were wondering if I was like a secret Maoist or something. So they asked us questions. We wanted to know really who was our leader, who we worked for, and whether we're getting money.
What do you think they smelled about the Red Book? I mean, this is something you buy openly in on a souvenir stand in Tiananmen Square, right?
Yeah.
And presumably it's completely encouraged and not considered at all subversive.
Yeah.
Right? So.
I mean, I think they were just confused. They were, right. Why would someone read this? Is this some kind of like, is this a leader because he has this book, mm-hmm. perhaps? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they wouldn't expect a Westerner to have this.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm. Pretty funny, though. A lot of times they want to know who we worked for or whether we're getting money for this. And I think that they thought we were working for the U.S. government. At one point in time, they asked us, you know, did the embassy send us? Did the embassy send us?
Ah. Mm.
Did the embassy send us? And obviously we didn't. You know, they didn't. We all went on our own free will. And they just really were getting at this. And all of us separately, even though we were all separate and it was, you know, threatening for more people than for others, we didn't tell them anything more than what they already knew, which was that we did this action because we believe in the freedom of Tibetans and we believe in ending the occupation of Tibet.
Mm. Yeah. Or you told them that.
We told them that, but we didn't really get beyond that. We said, we care. Yeah, we care about Tibet, just like the world cares, and just like everyone else cares about Tibet.
And how did they react?
They said, to different people, one person they called very stupid. They said, you are very stupid. You are very, very stupid. To me, they said I didn't know my history and that Tibet's always been a part of China. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, they were saying, you know, how would you like it if New York was free from the United States? I say, well, you know, that's a different case, maybe.
Personally, I'll advocate it, but
yeah, that's not the worst thing for me either. But they didn't know my personal politics.
Yes. All right. So for 12 hours, you were held.
We were held. They tried to get us to sign some things we couldn't read in Chinese, and none of us signed them, or we wrote, "I don't understand this," and we signed our names. And we were held in an auditorium room with about 10 people next to us. Some of them fell asleep as they were watching us. And some of us fell asleep. One of them engaged in a conversation with us, with one of the women, for all the night. And we weren't sure if he was just trying to be nice or if he was trying to really figure out some information.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, we thought he was just trying to figure out some information because mm-hmm. he went back to being a pretty mean person in the morning.
Hmm.
Trying to figure out what our motivation was, trying to be really friendly, asking us, you know, what we do, who we are. When he asked us our religions, and when we asked him his religion, he said, "I have no religion. I am communist.
Mm-hmm.
I believe nothing." Well, I thought that meant nihilist, but, you know. yeah, and then at one point, about 10 a.m. in the morning, they came in and told us to get our bags, and we're going.
Uh-huh.
Another thing. Before that, at one point in the night, maybe 5 or 6 a.m., they made us all go outside, pick up the banner again that said Free Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
And they made us hold the banner with all the lights on it, and then they took more pictures of us.
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed, because they didn't get enough, I guess.
How interesting.
Yeah, so besides that little journey, that was... One other thing. They searched us for money. And for credit cards.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they really wanted us to pay for our own tickets back. Yeah, that's what they've been doing to people. They were swiping credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't find ours.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you just not bring a credit card in anticipation of this? Or?
We knew they would search for it, so we put them somewhere.
Okay, but you already had your return tickets back, so...
Yeah, but they weren't going to wait for that.
Right.
We were, you know, it was a bet. We were betting on that they would send us back right away because they didn't want the media spectacle saying, you know, 5 Americans held for Free Tibet protest
today, right, of course.
One more day.
Right.
So we were betting that they would send us back.
Mm.
And they did. They did to us. Some other people they didn't. They held for 5 days.
But right.
They did to us.
Well, the people they held for 5 days, they actually sentenced to 10.
Yeah.
But they didn't sentence you guys to anything.
They never get sentenced.
Right. Mm-hmm. You never saw a judge or anything like that?
No, never saw a judge. At one point they said it's illegal to have public demonstration. We should have gone to the permitted park.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard about the permitted park.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay, so they told us to go there, and they said, you know, the rest was – it was illegal because we didn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think – he said, I just want you to know why you're here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the actual mechanism of your deportation?
About 10 plainclothes people walked us to the airport, or drove to the airport, walked us to the line, and just surrounded us and filmed us, and bought our tickets, and just walked us right to the gate, basically.
Uh-huh.
So
you're just put on an ordinary commercial flight.
Ordinary commercial flight, and they let us go once we were on the passageway.
Uh-huh.
Funny enough, as we
which airline? Out of curiosity. All right. It escapes you.
I think it was United, maybe.
Okay.
It was one of them, yeah. Mm. Or it was Air China with another, actually. Mm. But funny enough, as we were walking to the airplane, we see two British people who were also surrounded by what looked like plainclothes police officers. And they come up to us and say, "You guys getting deported too?"
Ah.
We said, yes, we were, actually. And we told them we were doing it for a Free Tibet protest. And they were doing it for selling tickets on the street. They were arrested for 5 days.
Selling tickets to the Olympics?
Yeah.
Oh, really? So they weren't even doing a political protest?
No.
They were just scalpers.
They were just scalpers. They got 5 days in jail for that.
All right. It's mere seconds of 12:30 in the a.m. here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI at 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Jacob Blumenfeld. A activist who Many of you probably saw his photo in the newspaper where just a week ago tonight when he unfurled a glow-in-the-dark Free Tibet banner outside the Bird's Nest in Beijing. And fortunately, is none the worse for wear. You've been copying some more Tibetan music from your computer. Is that ready?
That's ready.
Maybe we should give that a whirl, and then I'd like to talk about some more of the political context around the Olympics and Beijing and the protests which took place there. And I've got a couple of announcements to make. So here, what are we about to listen to?
This is a Tibetan group called Ancho Dani.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's traditionally modern kind of blend. Yeah.
Right. And I've played some of their music. Maybe this is something we've already heard. But in any event, let's hear it again.
Thank you.
Yeah, Tibetan heavy metal sounds of Acho Dani. We actually have played that cut before. I had that one. But here, you also brought, you know, I'm not sure if we've heard Furbu T. Namgyal and his album With You. So let's hear a little bit of that. All right, some more Tibetan pop music coming at you here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. A couple of announcements, a couple of events happening over the course of the next week. Now, one of them is going to be that on September 5th, which day of the week is that? I should have had my calendar out. Can you tell me which day of the week September 5th is?
Friday.
All right, so it's going to be next Friday, a week from this Friday? Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. The Lower East Side Slacktivists are going to be at it again. You heard about the Slacktivists, Jacob? Yeah.
Yes, I did.
So just as we're opposing the displacement and cleansing of the Tibetans from their homeland, they're opposing the displacement and cleansing of us Lower East Side denizens from our neighborhood by rapacious landlords and developers. And they're going to be holding, in their typically irreverent style, they're going to be holding a donut social at the 9th Precinct on September 5th at 8 p.m. The 9th Precinct, of course, is on 5th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenues. So be there and bring donuts, I suppose. And then they're going to march to a couple of particularly some buildings which are owned by some particularly evil landlords, including, once again, they're going back to 47 East 3rd Street, which is owned by the Economakis family, which is attempting to evict the entire building. You heard about this story? They're attempting to summarily evict the entire building. Wow. To turn it into their own private mansion. They're using a loophole in the law. The law states that if a landlord wants to take over a apartment for family use, they have the right to do so. But they're saying, well, yes, we want all the apartments for our family use. So they're trying to evict the entire building and turn it into, you know, a mansion for a family of four. So, you know, it's just absolutely outrageous. Fortunately, they haven't been able to get away with it yet, but the matter is still pending in the courts, so they may yet get away with it. So, all right. So, and then they're going to be actually going to another building in the neighborhood, 176 East 3rd, where another landlord is attempting to harass out the old rent-stabilized tenants so as to do gut renovations and jack up the rent and get much, much, much more money, even though it means evicting a bunch of people, including a bunch of retirees who planned on living the rest of their lives there and can't afford to move anywhere else. So, once again, if you're a fellow Lower East Side denizen, be at the Slacktivist Donut Social at the 9th Precinct on September 5th, a week from this Friday at 8 p.m. And let some of the greedy neighborhood landlords know what we old school neighborhood folks think of them and their ilk. Once again, that's going to be on September 5th, a week from this Friday, 8 p.m. at the 9th Precinct on 5th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenues. And then finally, let me not be remiss and announce the first in our fall series of anarchist forums sponsored by the Libertarian Book Club at our new location, which is at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street, on the Lower East Side. That's Avenue B, south of Houston. And on September 9th, which is going to be, I guess, two Tuesdays from now, there is going to be a sort of a debate on anarchist views on the elections, which is going to be featuring Judith Molina of the Living Theater and Bob Erler of the Libertarian Book Club, among others. And if you want to speak yourself, you could drop Bob Erler, who's organizing this gig, a line at Robert Erler. Just like it sounds, Robert Erler, E-R-L-E-R, at Errols.com, E-R-O-L-S. Robert Erler at Errols.com. If you feel that you need to address the issue of the perennial question of whether or not anarchists should vote. And this time around, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, yes, anarchists should vote this time around. I don't know if you agree with me or not, Jacob, but... Or if you want to weigh in on this question.
I'm from California, and I only vote for one party. the Peace and Freedom Party, which runs Leonard Peltier usually.
Oh, yeah? Really, do they?
Yeah.
They run Leonard Peltier for president?
Yeah. So I support them every time.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to China and Tibet, you know, it's interesting you should mention Leonard Peltier. Because, I mean, to me, you know, the whole question of justice for the Lakota people and other Native American peoples who have been disenfranchised of their land and sovereignty here in the North American continent is essentially the same issue which the Tibetans and the Uyghurs and the other indigenous peoples of China's far west are facing. And yet, unfortunately, you know, when we've taken listener phone calls, as perhaps we will in about 45 minutes from now, on the question of Tibet, some people out there don't seem to get it. And they seem to think that China is socialist and that any opposition, including the, national struggle of the Tibetans, is ipso facto organized by the United States or the CIA or George Soros, etc. So, I mean, when you were asked by your interrogators if you were on the payroll of the U.S. Embassy, probably a lot of our listeners out there would want to ask you the same question.
No.
Well, maybe they'll have a chance to put the question in their own words. Put it to our guest, Jacob Blumenfeld. If you're just tuning in now, Jacob Blumenfeld was 1 week ago tonight in Beijing, getting arrested outside the Bird's Nest for unfurling a banner that said "Free Tibet," which you had out for all of around 20 seconds before they moved in on you. So well, one thing which I've been following, which is rather interesting, one of your fellow protesters, a guy by the name of Adam Zenko, had a letter in the New York Times. Actually, this was the day after you were arrested. It was August 20th. So I guess he must have been arrested before you, but he was also arrested and deported from Beijing. And he was responding to a column by New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who wrote a column called "Malcontent Need Not Apply," which was decrying the fact that all of the local Chinese who actually applied for permits to protest in Beijing during the Olympics were not allowed to do so. But he wrote in his column that, despite this authoritarianism, China is no longer a totalitarian state, quote unquote, and that it's moving in the right direction, and we have to sort of help it along in the right direction. And your comrade Adam Zenko writes, "Imagine my surprise to learn from Mr. Kristof that China, quote, is no longer a totalitarian state, quote unquote. If he could somehow share this with the many thousands of Tibetan political prisoners, they would be gladdened to hear it. Also, please pass the word to the undercover policeman who punched and kicked me on August 10th while I stood near Tiananmen Square holding a banner reading, 'Tibetans are dying for freedom.' Adam Zenko, San Francisco, August 20th, 2008. The writer is a member of Students for a Free Tibet." Wow. And, I was glad to see this was actually on the front page of the New York Times, but there's a certain sense, there was a story that went along, there was an actual news story that went along with Nicholas Kristof's column. There was actually a front page news story in the Times that went along with Kristof's column about the fact that the Beijing authorities essentially pulled a bait and switch on the protesters. They actually set aside a protest area, an official protest area, a designated protest site, just like the authorities are doing undoubtedly in Denver and Minneapolis right now. But any Chinese people who Chinese citizens who applied for a permit were either denied the permit or talked out of it or, in many cases, arrested. for having applied for the permit. And some of them apparently are still being held. And the issues which they attempted to protest over had to do, by and large, with either urban people in Beijing being pushed out of their neighborhoods by development, the same issue which we're facing on the Lower East Side and throughout New York City right now, and particularly about the development which took place in prelude to the Olympics, with the Olympic Village being built. And you can probably tell us more about this. But also people out in rural areas, peasants who were being pushed from their lands by development projects and by corrupt authorities and so on. I mean, you know, my response to the notion that that China is socialist, well, I mean, it's socialist in name, but if it actually behaves exactly like capitalism, then obviously the name doesn't mean very much. So, but it's very interesting that in Nicholas Kristof's column about this whole affair, Malcolm Tense need not apply. You know, he says that, you know, China is no longer a totalitarian state in spite of this. So, I mean, yes, the fact that they actually did put aside a designated protest area means that to a certain extent they're moving towards repressive tolerance as opposed to just outright repression. But the fact that many of the people who actually applied for permits to protest were arrested for applying indicates that they haven't even moved too far in the direction of repressive tolerance. This is very indicative. The fact that that Kristof puts forth this analysis is very indicative of the way the U.S. elites think about China. They've sort of got this very ambivalent, equivocating kind of thing, because on one hand, China is a U.S. partner in globalization. And on the other hand, it's a U.S. imperial rival. But it was, you know, basically from when was Nixon's trip to China?
72.
From 1972 until the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, China was on our side, quote unquote, you know, against the common enemy of Russia. And really, you know, the renewed rivalry is really just a thing of very recent years, so the past few years. Would you agree?
Yeah, from what it seems like, it's a strange rivalry. I mean, there's a lot of debate or a lot of projections that China will invade the United States or because China's building up its military. It's hard to say if that's, you know, just speculation from fearmongers. It seems like the real threat is economic control.
I can't imagine. It would be a completely different world if China ever had the wherewithal to invade the United States. I mean, maybe a century from now, if China dramatically advances and the U.S. dramatically declines, it might just be vaguely possible, but it's really, really hard to imagine.
Yeah.
The real threat, I think, is that China is going to become a very significant regional power, and the U.S. is no longer going to be the world's lone superpower. That's the threat.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's the rivalries over capital. It's who will get more investment, and where were the development, where were the global capitalists invested? Will they invest in China or the U.S. market? I mean, it seems like China has huge foreign investment, huge investment in buildings, infrastructure, in private spaces, and all these things that the U.S. was leading in for long. And it seems like China's new capitalists are really rising.
There's a new scramble for Africa going on, particularly over Africa's oil and mineral resources. And, you know, a century ago, the scramble was between Britain and France and Germany and Belgium. Now the scramble is largely between the U.S. and China.
Yeah. Another issue in the Olympics was China's involvement in Darfur that some people were talking about. And some athletes, I think, said something about there's never some pressure for China to stop supporting Khartoum, I think, in this case. So, yeah, there is that China involvement in Africa, too. And you could see this is playing out, and who knows how it'll play out in the future.
Right. So what did you find out when you were in Beijing for how many days all told?
A week, 7 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what were you able to glean about the development which took place in preparation for the Olympics? And
well, I mean, it's an incredible city. I saw the richest city in China during its richest moment made for rich people to come visit it. So it was totally cleaned of any specks on its window shield. It was totally whitewashed. Everything was made to look perfect. It was incredible. I didn't see one poor person in the streets of China.
Wow.
I didn't see one street vendor selling food in the street.
Wow. Now, were you able to walk around independently, or were your wanderings controlled?
No, we took taxis and we wandered around a bit. Mm. It's just really hard to find something that wasn't already pre-decided that they will be blocked. One thing they do is they put these huge billboards, like maybe 30 feet high, with pictures of buildings and flowers and with sayings like "Build Great Beijing, Olympics 08. They used huge billboards and they covered any areas that looked kind of dirty or like shacks. So from the ground level, you would just see billboards on the side of you lining the streets and you didn't know what was behind them. Only from my 10th floor apartment or from our 10th floor room could we see that there was, you know, poor areas.
Okay, now what did they look like? What did the poor areas look like?
Only from above I saw just shacks like a shantytown. Yeah, and but you couldn't see that.
So they were close enough to your hotel that you could see them from the
10th
floor.
Yeah, but Beijing's a huge, sprawling city, so we were, you know, 45 minutes outside of the city center in a car, but we're still in the city.
Right.
So the city's been developing so rapidly, faster than anything I've ever seen. There's been, like I said, $40 billion worth of development backed by the Chinese government. And they've gotten the hottest architects in the world to build their new buildings. It's like walking into a museum of architecture, being in that city. From the Bird's Nest to the Cube to the CCTV building, which is designed by Rem Koolhaas. It's this building that goes up and then curves around and then comes back down. It looks like it from outer space. There's this thing called the Egg. It's this theater. It looks like a spaceship. Even the shopping malls are all crooked and curved, super modern, and I think they're here just to attract the vanguard of capital, attract the rich Chinese and rich developers to say, wow, this is really a modern city. It's really cleaned up. We could really be safe investing here. One thing they try to do is they try to clean the air by only letting half the cars on the street each day. They shut down factories for a week. They said they allowed freedom of press for the month, but that turned out to be a lie because they did regulate the internet for that month, and reporters covering protests weren't allowed to report. They shot iodine capsules into clouds to stop the rain, which sounds like something out of a science fiction book. But yet
there was smog, at least for the first opening days.
There was smog. It wasn't as bad as I've heard. L.A. was probably worse, but. But yeah, they did this total facelift to the city. They transferred out so many people. From what I read, over 50,000 people were transferred out of the city, either paid or forced or arrested to just leave, come back later. Similar to what they did in Tibet. They took a lot of Tibetan monks from the main cities of Lhasa and sent them to rural areas for the duration of August, to the monasteries. They closed monasteries. They tried not to let freedom of travel. They didn't want anything going on in Tibet during the same month as well. So what they were doing in Beijing to their own Chinese citizens, they were also doing to Tibetans. So I think there's a similarity of control here going on. It's not just their military occupation of Tibet. It's like, no, it's also this capitalist occupation of Beijing as well. It's not just by force. It's by economic control. What else in the city? They had tons of advertisements all over the city, sponsored by Nike, by Coke, by McDonald's. It was much more corporate than any American city I've ever been to.
What do you mean by more corporate?
It seems like every billboard was sponsored by something. Every store I went to had some kind of McDonald's or Starbucks logo. Even the
Perhaps as corporate, but more corporate.
Yeah, probably as corporate. Something strange I noticed was in the Forbidden City, which is the center of Beijing, where the old emperor lived.
Yeah,
they have these plaques that tell you about each little old kind of shrine or old area where the emperor sat.
In English and Chinese.
And they're all sponsored by American Express.
You've got to be kidding me. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I don't even understand how you could sponsor a plaque or something.
That's worse than I imagined.
Yeah, there used to be a Starbucks in Tiananmen Square, but they kicked it out. Or it closed. I don't know if they kicked it out. So there's 70 Starbucks in Beijing, by the way. We got a Starbucks map of Beijing. So it's really trying to attract new capital, trying to attack new developers. Equality levels are starkly, they're as bad as the U.S. And there's areas of Beijing that are gated communities now, with servants. There's supposedly 4 million floating migrants, according to Beijing statistics. But people say there's anywhere from 4 to 40 million migrant laborers.
In the country or in the city?
In Beijing.
In Beijing.
Yeah. In the country, there's like at least 40 million. Mm-hmm. So it has to be more than
all right, four. Now, these are like former peasants who have recently lost their lands and have been reduced to being migrant laborers.
Migrant laborers, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of this, you know, even though it's such a tightly controlled city where protest is illegal, I found out that there are tons of disputes every day in rural China. Supposedly there were 70,000 like rural disputes on average each year.
Right.
And they're about land. They're all about land. I mean, the redistributed land has been redistributed back to the private interests. And so they become migrant laborers, and they're the ones that built the bird's nest. They're the ones that built the CCTV building. They work 7 days a week. Sometimes they didn't get paid for months at a time.
CCTV?
The CCTV building, which is the TV station that it's the main TV mm-hmm. station. All the channels, or almost all of them, are CCTV.
Mm. Now, they didn't get paid for months at a time.
Yeah.
Well, how did that work?
I don't know. Some of them committed suicide, we read. Some of them jumped off the building.
All right, now, where did you read this? Presumably not in China.
Not in China. This is a book.
Yeah, book. Lay it on.
A book. This is a book put out by Seven Stories Press called China's Great Leap.
Uh-huh.
The Beijing Games and Olympian Human Rights Challenges.
Oh, my goodness. Great.
So it's a book of...
Who's the author?
It's edited by Minky Warden.
Uh-huh.
And it has about 20 different contributors, half Chinese, half not, exiles, and some people that were lived through Tiananmen, some people that are Olympic historians, some people that are human rights historians. And they just go through what happened since 2001 in Beijing. And this is where I got most of my facts and statistics.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a photo essay about the migrant laborers. So,
great. Yeah. So somebody was actually able to take the photos and write the essay and fly under the radar sufficiently to be able to do that.
Yeah, people do get it under the radar. I mean, you know, internet's regulated, but there are hackers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
People do take photos. People set up blogs. No one really knows how, people are penetrating this wall, and it's hard to say how tightly they're controlling it. It seems like they let something happen and they control it afterwards, instead of trying to preempt everything. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's 2 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning here on Listener Supported Non-Commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Jacob Blumenfeld. And we could consider, should we be adventurous and take some listener phone calls?
Yeah, did you want to talk about the Tibet movement?
Yeah, sure. By all means, let's do that. Let's talk about the Tibet movement.
Yeah, I'm sure you've talked about it before.
Yeah,
but,
go ahead.
I think that since March, it's been really exciting. I mean, since in March, there was an uprising in Tibet by hundreds or thousands of Tibetans, monks. And I think what that showed to the world was that this is not something that people can stand for so long. It's not something that's going to go away. And it kind of, I think, what shook a lot of people to say, oh, my gosh, monks are protesting. I thought they were peaceful. And I think it maybe even woke up a lot of the Chinese government, the fact that this is not going away. And I think for people of conscience, people that care, people that support this movement for these basic freedoms, like freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, freedom to go out at night without curfew, freedom not to be detained arbitrarily, people that support these things, I think there's, they need to step up and start really making an effort to expose what's going on and to amplify the voices of people in Tibet already. And whether it's through actions like ours, whether it's through listening to Tibetans themselves and supporting their own campaigns, whether it's doing actions in China or outside of it, I think it's time that people need to really start getting more involved. Yeah.
Okay, now what I find heartening is, your activist background, you've been involved, for instance, in solidarity with Palestine.
Yeah.
And now you're involved with solidarity with Tibet. And I'd like to think that there are lots of people out there like you who understand the connections between these two issues. But unfortunately, you know, there is a certain segment of the left in this country which, you know, cheers on the Intifada but sees the Tibetan uprising of this year as, you know, merely an imperialist intrigue. And sees the Tibetan national struggle entirely as something which has been stirred up by the West and the CIA and intelligence intrigues and all that sort of thing. And interestingly, when I've got a news clip here from just about 2 years ago, from February of 2006, 2.5 years ago, when the Dalai Lama visited Israel. He met with... mostly met with religious leaders. No actual government officials would meet with him. And he was going to visit Bethlehem as well on the West Bank, and that was canceled at the request of the Palestinian Authority, which was unwilling to antagonize China. So they actually went even further than the Israelis did in trying to placate China, because, of course, you know, China, perhaps not so much these days, but traditionally, China has been, you know, a backer of the Palestinian cause. So there's this whole sort of, you know, global divide and conquer game, which is going on, which is just very, very deeply entrenched and so intractable that, you know, every show that I've done, and I've done a few this year, right, about... on the radio about either Tibet or about the Uyghurs. I assume you know about the situation with the Uyghurs in
Xinjiang.
In Xinjiang, exactly, immediately the north of Tibet, who also had a little uprising this year. And in fact, they're facing pretty severe repression at the moment. And during the games, they were facing pretty severe repression. Every, you know, time I've broached these issues and opened up the lines, we've gotten some very, I would say, knee-jerk reactions from the callers. Now, I would like to think that even here at WBAI, they don't represent a, you know, they aren't a representative cross-section of the listeners. You know, one hopes that, they're, just the ones who feel motivated to call in, which is why, you know, I'm reluctant to take calls when only a couple of people are calling. But, you know, we've actually got four people calling. Do you feel that this is how we should spend the last 20 minutes of the show?
Sure.
All right. Shall we do it? 212-209-2900 is the number. And give us a call if you have something to say. WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down the radio. First thing to do is to be standing at your radio so that you can turn it down immediately when we put you on the air so we don't get any horrendous bursts of feedback. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bill.
Hey, Amina.
Hi, Tashid Zalek. To your guest, thank you so much for what you did in Beijing. And thank you, Bill, for taking this issue on. You know, actually, like earlier this evening, I copied that photo of that action at the bird's nest, and I put it on my MySpace page. And I was wondering, I wonder if Bill's going to talk about Tibet tonight. And then I turned on the radio.
Synchronicity.
Yeah, something like that. But, yeah, I wanted to say that there's a Free Tibet TV website up that Students for Free Tibet put up during the week and a half of the Olympics. And there's some awesome footage and some awesome video interviews and different actions that took place practically every day. So I don't know the exact it's late for me. Oh, I think it's FT2008TV.org, but you know, like, look it up in a search engine. It's Students for Free Tibet, and they have like videos on a special website. But I just wanted to call to say that I'm really glad you're making the connections between, like, even gentrification in New York. You know, it's so applicable to a situation in Tibet, you know, and similar struggles like the Zapatistas in Mexico. It's the same thing, you know.
Yes, and the whole global divide and conquer trip is just extremely frustrating, and I hope that, you know, we can make some progress to overcome it.
Yeah, I was at a protest this past Sunday in front of the Chinese consulate with a lot of Tibetan groups. Like, there are thousands and thousands of Tibetans and supporters there, and it was, like, really awesome. And then when it was over and we were crossing 12th Avenue, there was one American guy all by himself standing on the corner waving a red Chinese flag saying CIA out of China. He was, you know, the counter demonstration. And I felt like saying, hello, the 70s called. They want their rhetoric back. And speaking of the Red Book, when I was young and in college, the Puerto Rican revolutionaries, some of the Puerto Rican revolutionaries used to read from Mao's little Red Book, and I think it's just so curious that what he was doing to Tibet then was worse than what the United States was doing to Puerto Rico. You know, but, oh well, it takes, what is it, hindsight, yeah. Okay. Well, carry on.
Right. Thank you very much for your call, Amina.
All right. Thank
bye. WBAI, you're on the air. Good to hear from Amina. Good to hear from someone who is on our wavelength here at the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Not that we don't want spirited debate and dialogue. We definitely do. So you needn't feel that, you know, you have to agree with us in order to call. 212-209-2900, because debate and dialogue is what it's all about. We just want debate and dialogue and not mere epithet hurling. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio, please.
It's down.
Okay.
Yes, good morning. I would just like to make a comment about last week's show. The last two callers called in and said that sometimes they think you're a little bit too harsh. Well, I disagree, and I hope that you won't change that, because I find you to be well-informed and intolerant of you know, people who don't have all the information together. So I just wanted to call to say that. I tried to call last week, but it was too late. So I hope you won't change it. Thank you.
Well, thanks. I do appreciate that very much. Although, just quoting your own words, you know, that I'm intolerant of people who don't have all their information together, that's not good. I should really be more tolerant of people who don't have all their information together, because not everybody is a professional journalist, as I am, or aspire to be, although to tell you the truth, I have to sell my labor as a copy editor in order to make ends meet. But, and certainly, you know, there's plenty of things I don't know, plenty of things I'm ignorant about, so I should be more tolerant of people who don't have their information together. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, Andrea Soros does the funding for her father. It's in the biography about Soros and all the Tibet stuff, number one. Number two, a Minky Warden, or whatever her last name is, she bragged when she had the police come after me that her husband works for the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Number three, a moment ago, I was attacked by police in front of 120 Wall Street, unfurling a banner of the Chinese, the Beijing Olympics in 2008. You're a bunch of hypocrites. You have 12 cops attack me at LSB meetings because I'm pro-China.
Okay, hang on a second. Why are you using the pronoun you? I certainly didn't have anybody attack you.
Coming after me.
I'm sorry, are you listening? I did not have anybody attack you. I want to be very, very clear about this, okay? I was not responsible for anybody attacking anybody or censoring anybody.
You're a hypocrite. Hypocrite. While you talk about freedom in China, you won't allow anybody who's pro-China to protest in front of 120 Wall Street. You're hypocrites. Mickey Warden.
Hang on a minute. Listen, will you be quiet for just a minute and let me talk to make something clear? I didn't know that you were out there protesting in front of 120 Wall Street. I support your right to protest in front of 120 Wall Street. I did not send any police or security people around. I didn't know anything about it. I support your right to protest in front of 120 Wall Street or anywhere else you want, sir.
Anybody like me who's a Marxist, and that's the truth.
Did you hear what I said? Could you give me some intimation that you actually heard what I just said?
Cover up. You're hypocrites. It's hilarious. We're having a meeting Thursday at City Hall, a at 9 a.m., a press conference on the steps of City Hall. And watch what happens. They're not going to let us get on the steps of City Hall the way the anti-China people got on yesterday. Right?
Well, I support your right to be on the steps of City Hall, so...
Anyway, no. We demand equal time on BAI News to defend China. Long live the People's Republic, BAI, CIA, hands off China, Russia, Zimbabwe. You want to dismember China bit by bit, piece by piece. Thurman, Professor Thurman for Columbia.
Okay, hang on a second. Do you support independence for East Timor? How about Puerto Rico? You support independence for Puerto Rico?
You want to dismember both the Soviet Union?
No. I asked you a question.
The truth. You are working on behalf...
No. I asked you a question. How do you feel about independence for Puerto Rico?
You want what Dick Cheney wants, to dismember Russia and China.
No. I asked you a question. Are you listening? How do you feel about independence for Puerto Rico?
And drag it into the right-wing fascist scum dirt.
You don't appear to be listening. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, my God. What is going... Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
This is great. This guy that's on air now just took my door. I just want to thank you for your probes and everything like that. That was very good reporting with your guest there. What was going on? I heard about some of the stuff that was going on, locking up the people and whatnot. So I just want to thank you for that.
Okay.
Thank you.
WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. Hello. Turn on the radio.
Yes. I have two questions. First of all, I have heard and seen publicity that Richard Gere is also on the side of the Dalai Lama.
Well, notoriously so, but so what?
What do you mean, notoriously so?
Well, everybody knows it, but so what?
Oh, I don't know. I thought it might have some relevance. Your guest might have something to say about that. The second thing I want to say has completely flown out of my mind.
Well, then call us back when you think.
No, I know what it is. Hello?
Yeah.
I know what it is. Earlier, in talking about Tibet, you said... It's, and you used the phrase a few times during the course of this conversation, divide and conquer. So who is doing the dividing and conquering in the Tibetan situation?
All right. Well, Jacob, do you want to take that on or shall I?
When you use the phrase divide and conquer, did you mean...
Well, I just mean that, you know, that a lot of the people who cheer on the Palestinian Intifada view the Tibetan uprising as entirely the work of the CIA. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of the people, you know, the reverse works out as well. You know, a lot of the people who were on board the Free Tibet movement don't seem particularly concerned about, you know, indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere or about the Palestinians or about the Zapatistas.
Yeah, I think it's people themselves who divide themselves from other movements. People tend to like have identities around certain movements, like, oh, I work on this, I work on that. But I think the larger issue is forming solidarity with across movements. And people tend to say, oh, no, that will corrupt my own political ideology. But I think...
The nature of the state system is divide and conquer. I mean, states are, particularly imperial states, are in rivalry with each other. And, you know, they will attempt to cultivate oppressed peoples and oppressed ethnicities of the other state as their allies and proxies.
One thing that happens a lot of times in capitalist states is that they tend to tolerate difference as long as they can market it, whether it's a new fashion or a new cultural identity. And it's possible that if China becomes more westernized or becomes more open to Western business practices, then they will start... you know, pacifying Tibet by selling it. You know, saying, oh, here's Tibetan culture. They're free in their culture that we can sell. And I already saw that when I was in Beijing. I saw, I went to an art district, and they had a Tibetan gallery there of Tibetan art. And I looked at it, and then I saw the funders, and it was all Chinese cultural institutions. There was not one Tibetan institution that supported it. And in the guest book, there was a huge guest book, and in Chinese and in English it said, Tibet will always be a part of China.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see this happening in the future. This,
now,
this,
a guest wrote that in the book, or that
like,
was?
That was in the guest book. Someone's like, oh, they probably planted it there, but I have no idea.
But it appeared so-called spontaneously in the guest book, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, shall we try to keep going with the calls?
Yeah.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, the Dalai...
No, had your chance. You didn't even answer my question, so WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. Turn down the radio. What's this nonsense? Okay, should we dispense with the phone calls, or are we going to have more intelligent people calling in? 212-209-2900. If you have anything to ask Jacob Blumenfeld, who is just back from Beijing, where he was arrested holding up a Free Tibet banner, this would be your opportunity to do so. If you have any question or commentary on what we're talking about, please give us a call at 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Yes, I just was wondering. It seems that whatever one's opinions are, there'll be others who will, you know, put down what you say. And that fellow you explained, you know, to who said you were such a scholar, which was a compliment, you yourself admitted to the fact that his opinion of you was not as sufficient as it should have been.
Okay, but the show's not about me. The show's about Tibet.
No, but I mean, this is the problem, Bill, that there's so many people with partial knowledges and so forth. Like Gary at our LSB meetings, he doesn't stop after 3 minutes.
Okay, the show, you should talk, Monroe. You should talk, Monroe. The show's not about Gary either.
No, but you give him a fair shot, and I think he should have more time on China. I do agree with him. Thank you.
Thank you. 212-209-2900 in the 10 minutes remaining to us. Well, this is usually the point when we're almost out of time, when the board lights up, so come on, everybody. 212-209-2900, WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio and speak up. Hello.
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 Yes, I want to make a comment.
Please do.
Yes, I no diminishing the Tibet situation or anything, but there's plenty of situations going on in America that we need to comment on and try to fix and remedy, because that's the same charge we're charging the Republicans with going to Iraq and trying to fix their problems. You understand what I'm saying?
Jacob?
I believe people should also, you know, work on domestic and fight their local enemies as well. But I think we live in a world where we have global enemies and not just local ones. So the same people that are oppressing us here are also the ones investing in repression in Tibet.
True, understandable in Africa and Europe and everywhere else in the world. But my view is we should concentrate home and fix the ills at home, and then that would most likely reflect throughout the world. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think different people will have to make that judgment call on where to concentrate your energies. I think that's a personal choice on what your beliefs are and what do you think is effective in the long run. I think that's really important to show resistance to the Republicans and the Democrats and to be an opposition force locally to your landlords, to your police force, to those polluting your neighborhood. But there's also time, I think, to talk about what those problems are in relation to a global setting. Like, are they really the cause, or are they just effects of a bigger cause, which is, you know, certain forms of governments and certain capitalist relations that tend to alienate and exploit people.
We should mention, by the way, that did you mention that you're about to leave for Minneapolis? Is that the case?
Yeah, I'm heading out there too. I always take time to fight my local enemies. I would never just go abroad when I have plenty here. But
right, so it's not like you're just you know, cutting the Republican slack to go jet setting off to Beijing.
Yeah.
Right.
But I agree. If you believe that, if you concentrated here, I support that 100%. It's not my, I'm not here to tell you to go to Tibet or go to China. I think people should fight where their energy is and where they believe they can be effective.
And in fact, I mean, you're an equal opportunity protester. You just protested in Beijing, and now you're about to protest at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio, please. Turn down the radio. Turn down the radio. Speak up.
Hi, Bill.
Yeah.
Are you on there?
Turn down the radio.
It's completely down.
Okay, good.
Okay. So I think a lot of the listeners would like to know, you know, how much China has, repudiated its past of the Maoist tradition, and if there's any remnant of it at all left. And the Cultural Revolution, did your guest question anyone about that kind of past, which was horrendous? That's my question.
So we didn't engage with political conversations with anyone because we thought that would tag us and that would get us arrested. But from what I learned there was that people consider the Cultural Revolution a mistake, and Mao is seen as 70% right and 30% wrong, according to the Chinese Communist Party.
That's
the official statistics.
That's the official line
The official line. Deng Xiaoping's term in the 80s, they decided that. And they also said the Cultural Revolution was wrong in fact, but right in spirit. So, yeah, it was a horrendous time. It was horrendous for the people all over China and for all the old institutions there, but also in Tibet. I mean, monasteries were burned to the ground. People were set off against each other, students against teachers, and the same thing happened there. We couldn't bring up Tiananmen Square. I mean, you know, Westerners think, when they think of China and human rights and politics, they think of Tiananmen Square in 1989, the massacre against the students, the uprose. But there's nothing there to document that, to monitor that, and we couldn't bring that up.
I would imagine.
These are all the questions that I was dying to talk about. You know, what about Mao? What about the Cultural Revolution? It's really a different time now. I mean, now it's the era of what they call the peaceful rise. The president, Hu Jintao, says, you know, harmonious society. He uses those words a lot. Development, and he even says democracy sometimes. They call it socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Right.
Which to me looks like capitalism with Chinese characteristics, but they continue the ideology of it. What I also learned is that, you know, it has developed its economy into a different kind of state than it was earlier on, but it's justified, it was justified by saying that the market isn't what distinguishes socialism and capitalism. It's really ideology.
What does ideology mean if it isn't reflected in social relations?
That's my question.
Yes, precisely. Yeah. I mean, I would argue that China has now got the worst of both worlds, that, you know, it's got some of the most savage capitalism on earth. But it hasn't even got any of the, you know, freedoms that tend to go along with, liberal bourgeois democracies. And because you've still got the one-party state, and the one party happens to be the Communist Party in name, but only in name. It's completely betrayed any actual socialist legacy. But because that happens to be the ruling party, it still does all of these atrocious things in the name of communism, even though it's the same atrocious things which, you know, our own government is doing in the name of capitalism.
I mean, similar to Mexico, who had a one-party dictatorship called the People's Revolutionary Institution.
Exactly. The Institutional Revolutionary Party.
Institutional Revolutionary Party, yeah. Right. And it was the same thing. They were the ones oppressing people in Chiapas and Oaxaca and Guerrero. So.
You got it. All right. Should we try to squeeze in one more call? I understand that Weaponry with Tom Whisker is canceled tonight, so you're probably going to get some rock and roll with Max Schmid, or you're going to get some extemporizing from Sydney Smith, but let's see if we can squeeze in one call in the meanwhile. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio, please. Turn down your radio. Turn down your radio and speak up.
I'm curious, for the time that you were arrested in Beijing, did they have the courtesy to feed you?
Okay.
Yeah, they did feed us. They gave us this dish called congee. It's this rice kind of... rice water.
Yeah, you can get it in Chinatown.
Yeah, you can get it in Chinatown. Yeah. They gave us congee.
Hmm. Was it good?
It wasn't that good.
What was in it, apart from rice?
It was this liquidy goo. I couldn't really distinguish what was in it.
Right. Should we try to squeeze in one more call, even though we only have like a minute left?
Sure.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, I remember the situation at Tiananmen Square. There was a big art show for downtown artists. And I was one of the few artists that told the truth, that the protests had really had nothing to do with democracy, but both the left and the right were lying and said that these students were protesting for democracy. These students were protesting for a little less pressure in the system, because they felt overworked. and overburdened. My question to you, sir, who are your American political allies as far as your cause is concerned?
You mean for freedom of Tibet?
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of Tibetans here in exile and tons of activists.
No, I mean the actual American politicians. Who do you feel is really sympathetic to your cause?
It's hard to say which one in particular. We try to talk to all of our representatives when we're doing these actions and get them to pressure it, but it changes, and there's none in particular that we feel is the strongest ally. Even though a lot of them do respect the Dalai Lama, it's usually just stops right there.
I just would like to compliment the Chinese community for finally making themselves visible, and I think this second generation, or I don't know how to decide it, first or second generation of Chinese kids are going to be very, very instrumental in determining world politics.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
There. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, it's 1:30. Max is pointing at the telephone.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.